Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m.
KABU is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2019-20 concert season. Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor kick off 2020 on Friday, January 17th. They are co-lead singers and primary songwriters for the Grammy Award-winning O'Connor Band. That's Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor, Friday, January 17th at 7:30 p.m., doors at 7, at the Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steel Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to The Food Show. I'm Emily Becker. Did you know that in Portland, about 10% of all workers are employed in the food industry? 10%, that's huge. Have you ever worked in a restaurant? I sure have. I spent a lot of years cooking and serving food in restaurants, and I never had any benefits. That's no sick days, no healthcare, no vacation, not even a set schedule or even any kind of job security. And when I lived outside of the Northwest, I made a tipped wage of as little as $2.13 an hour. And that's like 20 years ago, but still, way less than minimum wage. Workers in Portland are a little better off. They receive a regular minimum wage, but food system employees overall still face a lot of hardships. And that's what we're talking about today. We'll talk with food system workers who are finding solutions to make their lives and jobs better. We'll speak with Joshua Cole of Family Meal PDX, and their work to raise funds for restaurant and agricultural workers during medical debt crises. James Cox of the Restaurant Opportunity Center of the Bay will join us on the phone to talk about their work supporting restaurant workers in finding childcare. Don McIntosh of Northwest Labor Press will share some highlights of food system organizing efforts in 2019. And Rory from the new Grand Central Bakers Union will talk about organizing bakers in Portland. Let's start with you, Josh. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So Josh is the founder and executive director of a new organization called Family Meal PDX. Family Meal provides financial relief to food service and agricultural workers and their families during a medical debt crisis. Josh is also the assistant general manager at Ox and has worked for more than 10 years in the food service industry. Great to have you here. So Family Meal is raising money to support workers struggling with medical debt. Why specifically do you focus on food service and agricultural workers?
Well, this has been kind of a collection of stories that myself and fellow board members have accumulated over our years in the industry. You yourself had mentioned that you had spent many years working in the industry, and you've likely encountered folks that have struggled to make ends meet during a medical debt crisis. So the genesis of this idea is essentially rooted in the belief that societies function best when the fundamental needs of its citizens are met. If we accept that belief, then we really have a moral obligation to address those needs if there's a shortcoming in the system's ability to provide them, to meet them. Family Meal is a response to one of those shortcomings.
Cool. So you're raising money and you're going to provide funding to people who work in restaurants, probably mostly, right? And agricultural workers.
Correct.
But so, you know, is there anything special about why did you pick those people, those groups of people?
Good question. Yeah. It's near and dear to my heart. Mm-hmm. As you said, I've worked in the industry for over 10 years, going on 14 years now. And there's a large percentage of folks working in these industries that that lack insurance or are underinsured, which is the concept that you might have insurance, but it's inadequate to cover your medical expenses when some adverse circumstance you're confronted with an adverse circumstance. So that's why it's understanding that there's a need that exists across these industries and trying to address that need the best that we can, so individuals working in these industries can stay in them and continue pursuing their professional vocations.
Awesome. So how did you start the organization?
It's a good question. It was, again, a process of collecting stories from being in the industry for a number of years. The original genesis for the idea was to offer a venue for, it was going to be called Next in Line, and it was going to be chef de cuisines working in kitchens and giving them an opportunity to do this collaboration dinner to provide them an opportunity to demonstrate their craft and get it in front of the Portland and Oregon public. And then the funds raised from that would go to different charitable organizations. That was about a year and a half ago when the idea was first came to light. And then over a process of tailoring and having conversations with different community members, it was really recognizing that the need, that there was a need that needs to be met, which is financial security during a medical debt crisis. So once we addressed that that was really the focal point of this organization, we just kind of went ahead full steam to make sure that the structures and systems were in place to develop what became Family Meal. So the idea started about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. We launched, our fundraising launched November 1st, so we're still a pretty young organization, just about 2.5 months in.
Awesome. Tell us about the name. How'd you come up with Family Meal?
So colloquially, Family Meal is known as a time during the day when front of house and back of house gets together to enjoy a meal either before or after a dinner service. This is kind of an opportunity for people to tune out the stresses of working in a restaurant, just enjoy each other's company, and either decompress from the service that you had or just take a moment to yourself and be with your colleagues in a non-service atmosphere.
Awesome. That's nice. So how does the organization work? So you have a bunch of collaborators and you're going to have these fundraising dinners, but like, how are you actually functioning?
Sure. You mean how do we issue grants or how are we fundraising? Mm-hmm. So we are issuing grants. There's a two-part application process. The first one is an opportunity for us to essentially vet applications, make sure that they meet our qualifying standards of qualifying work. So that can be found on our website. We just require that you are either a food service or agriculture worker, as we discussed. Once you demonstrate relevant work history, then we provide you with a secondary paper application, which is essentially a worksheet that helps us understand how we can best help you. To be clear, we don't pay down medical debt. We pay down or help cover the cost of living expenses that applicants incur during medical debt crises. Mm-hmm. We found, based on conversations that we've had, it's most important to keep people in their homes, pay utility bills when individuals are confronted with these medical debt crises. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we're at with the application process.
Cool. So, okay, that's great. I didn't understand that. So how did you, like, were there examples of people you talked to who are like, you know, like, I'm going to figure out with the healthcare company or whatever, like, they're going to give me a discount, or like, there's some way I'm going to figure out how to pay for this debt, but what I really need is, while I'm paying that off, I need to be able to have stability in my housing and having my utilities turned on and having
that's
a phone
exactly
and having
right.
a car. Yeah.
Yeah. So medical debt collectors can certainly be persistent. There's no doubt about it, and increasingly so. But as you alluded to, it's critically important that if you have a house and you're paying a mortgage or paying a rent, that there's a roof over your head. There's a similar organization that we touched base with once we had developed our concept and our organization. We were introduced to the Giving Kitchen, which is based out of Atlanta, and we were able to kind of pick their brain based on the experiences that they've had, and they helped us kind of confirm what we thought, which was make sure the basic needs of these applicants are met so they can confront the seemingly insurmountable medical debt with the security of a roof over your head and your heat paid and your water bill, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So how much money are you guys hoping to raise?
Massive amounts. it's right now we are capacity building. It's important for us to make sure that we are tailoring these grants in such a way where we're able to meet the needs of the applicant on a one-time basis. We're not going to provide ongoing support, at least right now. We want to make sure that we're able to provide as broad an impact as possible when growing our impact. Or our capacity, excuse me. Right now, we are doing these collaboration dinners, which are at least slated for twice yearly events. We just had one last Saturday, which was held, and it was great. 100% of the proceeds that are raised go to these relief grants. Nobody on the staff is getting paid, so it's an opportunity for us to make sure that we're providing as large an impact as possible.
Very cool. So that's very exciting. I kind of want to ask, like, you know, I think this is an awesome solution, right, to a very particular need. And everybody else on the show today is going to talk about that as well. But it does seem like, you know, you mentioned earlier that some people in the restaurant industry have healthcare insurance and some of them are underinsured, but a lot of them don't have insurance, right? And so it's just like, you know, how like, you know, is a better solution or is another solution to encourage or get restaurants to offer healthcare insurance to their employees?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. The challenge specifically with regards to restaurants is that the profits are just so small. Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association estimates that 95% of every customer dollar goes right back out in the form of wages, the myriad costs of inventory, repair and maintenance. I mean, all of the costs associated with running a restaurant. That just doesn't leave a lot of room for employee-sponsored benefits like health insurance. It's just so expensive. Recognizing that, that's kind of the void that Family Meal hopes to fill. This certainly isn't an indictment of the restaurant industry, far from it. This is a celebration of it. But the profit margins are particularly slim. And those plans that a lot of employers can afford are often, even if they're low premium and people can afford them, are high deductible, which again leaves people functionally uninsured if they're confronted with some adverse circumstance that strikes them.
Right. So, like, you know, a restaurant might offer health insurance, but at like 50% of the cost, right? Like they'll pay for 50% or something, and then that's still maybe a few hundred dollars out of your paycheck that you might not.
Or if you have an $8,000 deductible, there are very few restaurant workers that I know that are able to shell out $8,000 to help pay for or to pay for this adverse circumstance that you're plagued with. So,
Yeah. So it's like healthcare. Health insurance would be a good solution, but it's not necessarily the way we do it here in the United States, not necessarily the best option either.
Yeah, far from it.
Yeah. Cool. So I think I kind of perused your website, which is familymealpdx.org.
Exactly right, yeah.
and it seems like there's a lot of different, you know, folks at all sorts of different levels of restaurants involved, all sorts of restaurants in the community. So it feels like a real, like, industry solution. Do you also have folks on the agricultural side of things that are participating?
We do. So there's two winemakers, Mimi Castillo from Hopewell Wines. She's situated in the Valley. We have Ross Maloof, who is a winemaker as well. It's definitely, it's important for us to have a board as representative of the demographics that we aim to represent as possible. Mm-hmm. So as this organization continues to grow and expand, we look to collaborate with as many different people as possible.
Awesome. So it's a, do you have to live in Portland to get a grant?
Absolutely not. No, we're able to provide these relief grants to all Oregonians.
Very cool. That's awesome. And then what about people in Washington? Are you thinking?
At this point, it's specifically relegated to Oregon food service and agricultural workers. Mm-hmm. If we are able to grow and scale this organization in such a way where we are able to provide these services to other states, that would be a testament of the success of the organization. But currently, it's just food service and agriculture workers in Oregon.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So how can people, like how can our listeners support Family Meal?
There's a number of ways. One of them would be, you know, support your local restaurants, buy local products from Oregon agriculture centers. You can make donations through our website at familymealpdx.org, sign up for our newsletter and stay abreast of the chef collaboration and winemaker dinners that we're having, and stay tuned to what we have going on as we continue to move forward.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Next up, we have on the phone James Cox from the Restaurant Opportunities Center of the Bay. James is in Oakland, and they are a parent care share project manager. James is also a single mom, community activist, artist, and restaurant worker. James has over 15 years experience in the restaurant industry and had been looking for and trying to come up with creative childcare solutions for a year before starting to work with Restaurant Opportunities Center. Welcome, James.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. So finding and paying for childcare is a huge issue for a lot of families, you know, right up there with affordable housing and healthcare, which we were just talking about. So tell us why it's specifically difficult for restaurant workers. What kind of issues do they face in finding childcare?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. So it's really difficult for restaurant workers if you, you know, maybe if you don't work in the industry. If you think about the times that you go out to eat, it's usually in the evening and it's usually on the weekends when you have time off. And if you are a tipped worker, if you're a bartender or a server or, you know, anybody who makes tips, those are the best shifts to work, evening and weekend shifts. Some jobs, like when you go for an interview, they ask you right away, do you have evening and weekend availability? And if you don't have evening and weekend availability, they won't even consider you for the position. And so for parents, you know, childcare centers are usually open, like to serve people who work 9 to 5. And so when your shift starts at 4 o'clock at night or 5 o'clock at night, when all the daycare centers are closed, it's really challenging, and they're not open on weekends either. And so, you know, we also work on holidays. And so, yeah, it's extremely difficult with the hours we work. You know, sometimes, you know, a lot of people have a set schedule. They know that they're going to work Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, off on holidays. Restaurant workers, their schedules can vary from week to week. I've definitely, you know, I've been in restaurants for about 16 years, maybe more now. But I've definitely worked in places where I don't even get my schedule until Sunday night, and I find out Monday that I'm working. It's just, it's really unstable and just unpredictable, and that really does not work with how standard and traditional childcare and daycare centers operate.
Yeah, that's super challenging. So tell us a little bit about your personal experience. Like, what was it like to try to find childcare for your family that worked with your schedule?
Yeah, sure. So my daughter is actually about 4 and a half now. She'll be 5 in April. She's growing so fast. And I moved here from Chicago in 2012, and I had her in 2015. And so my family, shout out to my mom. She said I had to shout her out.
Hi, Mom.
My family is all in Michigan. And my daughter's dad's family is all in Chicago, and so we don't have any, you know, family here. And so my daughter's dad is actually in the industry as well. He is an executive chef, and so his hours are crazy, my hours are crazy, and we literally have zero family here. And so we found that what we had to do is just rely on friends, mostly friends who also worked in the industry. On their off day, they would watch her for us. Or, you know, roommates. Everybody in the Bay Area has roommates because it's so expensive and nobody mm-hmm. lives alone. And so, you know, roommates, just like friends, which are, you know, really chosen family at this point. And so, yeah, just kind of piecing together daycare, which is like really unstable. You know, one day she would go over here to this person's house. Another day she would come over here to this person's house. And it was just really scattered. But I've been really blessed recently to find a super solid daycare provider. I do have to drive 15 miles one way to get there, so I'm driving 30 miles every day to find daycare for my daughter. But you know, she's really flexible. She works with our schedule. If I'm late, she's like super, you know, lenient. She doesn't charge me extra. They go on field trips every week. So yeah, it's kind of just been, you know, finding what I can, and just really relying on community and people who are in, you know, similar situations or, you know, the same industry.
Yeah, so it's really one of those situations where your community is just taking care of your community. And
oh my God,
yeah,
totally.
And it's amazing and beautiful, but it's also not necessarily like, you know, people aren't getting compensated for the work they're doing in a fair way either. So it's kind of a hardship for them too. I totally get that. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about, I guess I should say the way I found you, because you're in Oakland, is that, well, mm-hmm. one, the Restaurant Opportunity Center is awesome and everybody should check them out.
Amazing.
But two, y'all did a research project with Tipping Point, which is another organization that kind of did research around this issue of childcare for restaurant workers. Mm-hmm. Can you talk, and I read some of the reports and stuff, can you talk a little bit about that research?
Yeah, sure. So that was, I was actually a participant at this point. When they did most of that research, I was a community organizer at ROC. This was last year, and I was doing some racial equity for restaurant workers, so that was my focus. But I wasn't part of the research, but I was able to be a participant in the focus group that they held for childcare. But I do know about some of the research that was done, even though I didn't participate directly in finding out that research. But I know that about 1 in 11 Americans work in the industry. So that's a pretty large number. And I think it's something even like 1 in 2 Americans had their first job in a restaurant. So
wow.
Yeah, there's like a lot, even if you're not currently working in restaurants, like most likely at some point you have. And then in the Bay Area, 1 in 6 households is led by single moms. And nationally, 42% of moms in the industry are single mothers.
Mm-hmm.
For the Bay Area, the average annual income is about just a little over $30,000, whereas the self-sufficiency standard for the Bay Area is about almost $86,000. And then childcare is around $14,000 to $23,000, which is about 40 to 70%.
That's insane.
Of someone's income.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to think about our, you know, our minimum wage out here. It's $15 an hour, you know? So if the minimum wage is $15 an hour, you can't really like ethically or legally or consciously like pay somebody to watch a whole living being, you know, your child for less than $15 an hour. So you have to look at somebody making minimum wage, you know, think about like a, you know, fast food worker or something, making $15 an hour and then having to turn around and pay $15 an hour to have somebody watch their child. It's like so many people are dropping out of work completely because they're basically working to pay for daycare and they have nothing left over. And that's not even factoring rent after that.
Yeah.
So
one of the things in that report that stood out to me was that it said that restaurant workers of color make 27% less than their
that's
white peers.
That's actually my next point.
Yeah, that was going to be my next point. Like, it's also, it's not just like people don't make enough money to do this, but then also people of color are disproportionately affected.
Yeah, people of color are definitely disproportionately affected, particularly women. You know, there's like the gender gap, but then also when you place, race on top of that. So a black woman or a woman of color gets paid, I don't know the exact amount, but definitely a lot less than a white man. And when I was doing the racial equity report, the project last year, we found that, you know, most management, upper management in restaurants was, you know, white men. People of color usually held the lowest paid positions, such as, you know, dishwashers and line cooks and prep cooks and, you know, things like that. And so that work that we did was trying to get restaurants to understand the difference between diversity and equity. Diversity is having, you know, like, oh, we have four people who work here of color, but they're all bussers. You know, that's diversity. Equity is like, oh yeah, we have four people of color who work here. Two of them are managers. You know, one of them is lead bartender. And, you know, so yeah, definitely that's an additional struggle, because also in the Bay, it's people of color, mostly black folks, who are losing their houses at alarming rates due to gentrification and, you know, the landlords or whatever selling their houses out from under them. So it's a really big problem, particularly for people of color.
Yeah. So y'all came up with this idea called, I think it's called Parent Care Share. Can you tell us about what that project is and how it works?
Yeah, so that was like the name, the kind of like a placeholder name. That's exactly what it is. It's a parent care share. But the official name is The Village. So yeah, we are creating an app. It'll be launching in February, early to mid-February. We're super excited. And the app is essentially going to be a place where restaurant workers can come, post a request for care. That request will be shown amongst a network of other restaurant workers, and parents are able to exchange childcare with one another for free instead of exchanging money. They basically exchange time. So mm-hmm. Say for example, I'm off on Fridays, you're off on Tuesdays. Like, I can watch your kid on Friday and you can watch my kid on Tuesday. And, you know, that way, that's how it's able to be free, is basically just exchange that time. And we'll have inner circles, kind of like different little villages around the Bay Area. And it'll be based on geographical location. So parents in the community will get to know, you know, other families from the community who also work in restaurants, really build a strong network, you know, get to know your neighbors, your friends will, you know, find new children to play with. And, yeah, that's essentially the idea behind CareShare, just to provide free childcare to restaurant workers. And the reason why we're going, you know, this route is because there's no, to get a space, to get a childcare, like a daycare center, you have to go through licensing and you have to, you know, acquire space, which rent out here, which we've already touched on, is very, very expensive. So this is kind of like the most like feasible way to sort of do it. And most people in California, I think the number is 49%, about 49% of California families are going through like friends and family and kind of like non-traditional, childcare models.
That's really cool. So the app hasn't launched yet, but you are doing some organizing of the parents, right? Is there already childcare happening?
There's not already childcare happening at the moment, no. So the app is getting ready to launch February. And so, yeah, my job is kind of, working with the developers who are creating the app to make sure that it's user-friendly, to make sure that we're covering all bases, like, is there like, you know, room to put, you know, kids' allergies? Because if you're watching somebody's kid, you need to know what their allergies are. Like, the really like the things that you really don't think about that you like need to put in the app. Like, I'm an artist, I'm not a tech person at all. So this is something like really new to me. I'm learning so much. And then also working with, you know, restaurant employers, talking to them about, you know, the resource that we have for their workers, how it can, you know, benefit their business. Like, if you have workers that, you know, have children, they could work a lot more, or they could, you know, be even more reliable, or maybe pick up more shifts if they had, you know, access to childcare. And then also talking to workers about, you know, the services that we have available. So right now it's just super heavy outreach to get ready for the launch next month.
That's awesome. So do you think that this is a model, since it's an app-based project, do you think it's a model that could get expanded to other regions of the country, maybe Portland?
Totally. That's the plan for sure. We don't want this to just be a Bay Area thing. And childcare, what's happening with childcare right now is, I believe, a national crisis, right? Because you have this model of 9 to 5, and, you know, as the cost of everything, you know, goes up, and people are, you know, student loan debt, and, you know, healthcare debt, all of this stuff, people are needing to get second and third jobs, and everybody has a side hustle, and people are doing Lyft and Uber. So I feel like there's really a need right now to you know, support working families, and for families to create additional income, and it's not just specific to the Bay Area. So definitely I think that thinking outside of, you know, the structures that we already have, or maybe waiting for government to step in and give more money to subsidies or do this or do that, I think that this is a way where we can support each other. And I think that historically, you know, if people have always, community has always supported community, right? So I think that's really the best way to move forward, and kind of just really, I know it's cliche to say, but really be the change that we want to see. Like, we can provide for each other. And the reason why the app is called The Village is because it's a village to raise a child. And we're going back to that model because it's going to take a village to raise our children, because we can't do it by ourselves, especially in this day and age, working 24/7, you know, hustling and bustling all the time, especially if you're a single mom. Like, you really, really need the support of the village.
Awesome, James. Thanks so much for being here today. Before you go,
thank you.
Can you tell us how people can find out more about the project and support your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can go to rockunited.org, and there's a little chapter button. Rock actually has 13 chapters across the United States, and so we're the Bay Area chapter. So you just click on a little Bay Area link, and then you can find out about all the work we're doing, and there's like a little separate page you can click on to get to childcare stuff. And then you can also follow us on Instagram at Rock the Bay, Facebook, Rock the Bay, Restaurant Opportunity Center of the Bay. Yeah, that's where you can find us.
Awesome. Thanks so much, James. Have a great day.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much. You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye. So our next guest is Don McIntosh. He's the senior staff reporter for the Northwest Labor Press, which is an independent union-supported newspaper. They print a paper, actual physical paper, which is really cool, twice a month. And you can read the articles at nwlaborpress.org. Don, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So Don, I asked you to be on the show to kind of, you're not a restaurant worker, you're not in the food industry, you're a reporter, which is awesome. But I asked you on the show to kind of give us some big picture perspectives on organizing efforts. And it seems to me like 2019 was a pretty big year for labor organizing in restaurants and grocery stores. Earlier this year in February, I talked to Burgerville Workers Union and New Seasons Workers. And, you know, I've heard about several other organizing campaigns. And after we talk, we're going to talk to Rory from the Grand Central Bakers Union. Why do you think people are organizing now? Like, why are unions a solution right now?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I altogether know the answer, but I think that your premise is right. I've been reporting now on organized labor basically full-time for the last 21 years, and maybe 10, 15 years ago, my friends would say, oh, Don, you've become such a pessimist and so forth. I don't feel that way anymore, and I think there's something that's changed. There's a new mood, a new atmosphere, and it's not just anecdotal, actually. Every year, the Gallup poll organization does a survey, and they look at basically Americans' approval rating of unions. And last year, it was among the highest it's been in 50 years. 64% said that they approve of unions. And when you drill down into those numbers, it actually gets kind of interesting because it's a little counterintuitive maybe. So young people, millennials, who were the least likely to be in unions, were actually had the greatest amount of support. So you had like about 10 points spread between younger and older workers. Also, workers of color, non-white workers, again, about 10 points more likely to support unions. And interestingly, college grads, also about 68% said that they supported or approved of unions compared to those with high school, it's about 58%. So I think that, you know, where you have in urban areas where workers are young, college educated, and of color, and then Democrats, it seems like there's you're very likely to be sort of a readiness to try to do something, act collectively, and, mm-hmm. and look at unions.
Very cool. So I mentioned Burgerville and New Seasons. I know there's like a few other. We talked a few like earlier today about it. Can you share some of the campaigns you're watching, some of the highlights that you've seen happening in like restaurants and grocery stores and.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's important not to lose sight of the biggest kinds of campaigns are going on at some established unions. So, for example, last year, the grocery workers, this is United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555 in Oregon and Southwest Washington. This is 20,000 workers in Fred Meyer's, Safeway, Albertsons, QFC. They won really a historic increase, raises ranging from $1.55 to $2.70 an hour over the next 3 years. Also, very importantly, they won the right to have 20 hours a week. For a long time, people were being underscheduled. 20 hours in those union contracts is the threshold where union pension and health care benefits kick in. So now, for those who want it, they'll have a guarantee of 20 hours a week. Again, that's huge. These are still relatively low-paid workers. They start at 10 cents above minimum wage, but the journey level, those who stick around for at least 4 years, they're going to be making what starts to be almost maybe a livable wage thanks to those gains.
That's awesome. And was that... forgive my ignorance, but was that quite a fight, or was it something they were just like, okay, cool? Yeah,
it was actually, and I think that's a really important point. Like, this is maybe one of the biggest, most successful contracts they've had. I think in part because they had more member involvement and more public. They really reached out to the public. In fact, the contract settlement took place 6 days after they launched a formal boycott. I mean, literally, these union workers are asking the members of the public not to shop at Fred Meyer until they reach an agreement. Apparently, they had. Anecdotally, anyway, quite an impact that the stores were much less busy and the online delivery services were, really slowing down quite a bit during that period. It got a lot of attention, I think, and so people maybe acted in solidarity and didn't shop at Fred Meyer for that duration. They also were ready to go on strike. They had a summer-long series of strike votes, overwhelmingly approving a readiness to go on strike. I was surprised that they got as good a settlement as they did without going on strike, but I think that Fred Meyer and the big grocery employers, I think we're convinced that they were serious.
That's awesome. I mentioned New Seasons. Would you know what's going on with their organizing efforts?
Sad to say, I don't want to speak for them, obviously, but I think, it's probably fair to say that campaign sort of petered out and withered away, and in large part because New Seasons, this B corporation that prides itself on being an ethical corporation, spent about $250,000 hiring high-paid union busters to come in and had meetings in every store, every shift, every worker was basically given the usual sort of boilerplate anti-union message. In fact, the same company was hired by the Trump Organization to fight unions at its hotel in Nevada. So this is New Seasons. Unfortunately, that's one of the sad stories is that many times when workers unionize, and those who've never been through this just would not believe what their employers are capable of, the sort of threats, intimidation, following workers around, firing. Very, very often workers will be fired, basically illegally, I should add, for speaking up or supporting the union openly. And that there's some reason to think that did happen at New Seasons, and certainly happens in many other cases. The other one I think we had talked about was Little Big Burger, right, which I'm very unhappy with that company right now, and in fact the owners of it. But basically, you had a launch last March of a public union campaign at one location, and the company got clever and did something a little unusual, which is they thought, aha, they haven't really had time to spread their union idea throughout our entire chain. Let's go to the government and ask for an election for the entire chain. And and then we'll squash them, and that'll be the end of it. Well,
can
you know,
an
didn't,
employer
it,
do that? Like,
it's very rare, actually. They're called RM petitions in my arcane world with the National Labor Relations Board, but they're quite rare. And usually, what they're used where an employer has an incumbent union, they're trying to make them go away. It's almost never the case that a non-union employer will ask for a union election. They usually fight them. But in this case, they had some clever legal advice, and it ended up, unfortunately, they won this round. The vote was 41-29 at the 12 Portland area stores. But it wasn't just that, you know, those folks weren't ready or hadn't had the message. That company also acted really, I think, unethically, in my opinion. So we had at least three, four employees who were open supporters of the union were fired. One of them, I'll just give an example. He'd worked there for 2 years. He arrives at work, and literally the company president and two district managers are waiting outside for him in front of his job, in full view of customers. They fire him. They said his offense was he failed to refill napkins and fry sauce containers on a closing shift 2 days prior. Not only was he fired, he was also banned for life from all Little Big Burger locations, and they threatened him with legal consequences if he came back. And this was, by the way, 2 days after he had gone around to other stores to talk with other workers about the union. So, I mean, on the surface of it, that's absurd. And I think anybody who hears that, you know, realizes that, you know, whether they win or not in the National Labor Relations Board process of challenging that firing, that's just an absurd thing to do in an economy where it's hard to find workers to fire someone like that. So that very often is what happens. And so workers will be fired, and that sort of has the chilling effect of intimidating other workers.
Yeah, and Little Big Burger, the owners of that company also own several other chains too, right? So I imagine that has an even more chilling effect. It's not just one chain of restaurants. It's also, I think it's like Boxer Ramen.
If you're thinking of Micah Camden. Now, Micah and Katie Pop, if I pronounce her name right, they're the founders of that. And by the way, I won't set in a foot in a Boxer Ramen or a little or the donut place either.
Blue Star.
Yeah. And the reason is, now, by the way, this campaign at Little Big Burger took place after they had sold it to Chanticleer Holdings, which is a company that owns Hooters, by the way. I call the company Little Big Tits now because of the Hooters Association. But anyway, that's my private nickname for them. The reason I won't shop or patronize the other establishments is because Micah Camden at Little Big Burger, before he sold it, was sued. There was a class action lawsuit against that company for systematic unpaid overtime, and he ended up settling for close to $750,000 with that class action, $675,000.
Just for wage theft.
Right. So to be fair to Micah, he wasn't the one that busted the union at Little Big Burger, but I think he has his own record at his other at the company beforehand.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the successes. I feel like you said something that really piqued my interest on the phone. You said something about the Oregon Zoo.
Well, this was actually quite a while ago. It was a really fun and exciting campaign. So basically, you had these really minimum wage cafe workers. They made your elephant ears up at the Oregon Zoo, or if you got the fries or whatever, they were the ones who did it. And they had this campaign called Zooladarity. And basically, they wanted to unionize, and they succeeded. They unionized with laborers, Local 483. Now, a few years later, and they won a first contract. I mean, their employer was Metro, which is the regional government, and, you know, not particularly evil. They, you know, so it wasn't that difficult to unionize, but, you know, and then get a contract. That enterprise ended up being outsourced to Aramark, and of course there was fear that, oh no, now they're going to go private and they won't get to keep their union. But they worked out a deal where they did actually end up keeping their union, and so I think clearly for those who work up there, the conditions and wages are better than they were a few years ago when they first started unionizing.
That's awesome. Any other successes you want to share?
Well, there's one very, very little one, and I'm glad it happens to be in my neighborhood, Scotty's Pizza. So I guess last fall, basically the 13 workers that at this little pizza joint, where they already paid $15 an hour, by the way, because it's pretty progressive business
and
owner,
healthcare.
They decided they wanted a union, and the employer, Scotty Rivera, did what I think most employers ought to do, which is said, okay, like, how do we get started? This is what's remarkable to me, because, I mean, today's unions, I mean, they're not like seizing the means of production or anything. They're basically asking that workers have some basic rights, that they have some procedural rights with discipline, that they have some path to a living wage, that they have a stake in the enterprise, and, you know, and a fair distribution of the profits. And so the idea that you as a business owner would have a problem with that really bothers me. And yet that's often the case. And even with, you know, so-called progressive business owners, you'll again and again, they're progressive until their workers, the day their workers come to them with a union, and then you'll see that you know, their true colors in that respect.
I think restaurants are an interesting case too, because a lot of restaurants start because somebody loves making something, right? Like they start because it's a chef-owned operation. They want to like make a thing. That doesn't mean they know how to run a business. That doesn't mean they know how to manage people. That doesn't mean they know the ins and outs of having employees and like how to care for them. And so like, I think in, you know, it's an interesting case when you have something somewhere like Scotty's, who I'm friends with Scott too, is a wonderful human being and he wants to do the best thing he can for everybody, but that doesn't necessarily mean he knows what's going to be best for the workers. And so the workers organizing and being able to say for themselves what we need. And I think that's so great.
I think part of it too is it's a little bit about power and about self-image. And the idea, I think, for some of the particularly smaller businesses, when they face something like that, they take it personally. They think, well, I thought I was like this great, you know, munificent employer, and now you're destroying our little family relationship and so forth. But you know, very often the workers don't perceive it the same way, and so that's a wake-up call. It's just too bad that they can't like just be adults about it and say, okay, I mean, up till now I've negotiated with each of you individually about your wages and conditions. Now you say you want to negotiate together. Okay, let's do it.
Exactly. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. How can people support Northwest Labor Press?
Well, if you want a paper subscription, it's 24 times a year. We think it's relatively a bargain at about $15. Check out, you can get that on our website, or just put your email in the little box on the side of the website and you'll get it twice a month anyway. We'd love to have readers who aren't in union members, and of course those who are. It goes out twice a month to about 50,000 union households, mm-hmm. but if you're not in a union, you might never see it. So we definitely would encourage you to come to the website and check us out.
Awesome. And what's that website again?
nwlaborpress.org.
Thank you so much, Don.
Thanks for having me.
Our final guest today is Rory, a member of the new Grand Central Bakers Union, which voted to unionize with the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco, and Grain Millers Local 114 last month. The union represents workers at the production facility here in Portland. Hi, Rory. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So what inspired you and your coworkers to form a union?
So some of my coworkers have been there for a really, really long time. We have people who've been there for like around like 5 to 7 years. And then we also have people who have been there for like 7 up to 20. And so some of the more long-term employees were like, they were just like reminiscing with a former coworker about the way things used to be, and also the ways in which like some of their working conditions had significantly deteriorated over like the long period of time that they've been there, because they really like have that ability to take the long view on that. And this former employee was like, well, you know what you could do, right, is you could unionize. And so they were like, yeah, actually, we want to do that. And so I think that was in like late summer, I think August. And so they very slowly like started talking to other employees and realized that they like really did have this strong base of support. Largely the issues were like specifically safety, but even more specific than that is like repetitive motion. When you hand make artisan bread, it's hard on your body and it's a lot of repetitive motion. And we are like one of the only bakeries of our size that does as much as we do by hand.
How big is the bakery?
So in our voting unit, there were 45 employees, and that's just bakers and dishwashers. We work in a warehouse. Like it's functionally a warehouse. We have a walk-in freezer that's probably bigger than your bedroom. We have two proofers that are like about the size of bedrooms. We have 3 hearth ovens and 4 Baxter ovens. It's a massive, massive place. Our mixers, we've got 3 of them, the largest of which can run like about 600 pounds of dough in one mix. So we have 3 crews. We have a AM crew, a swing crew, and a night crew. So it's going all the time.
Mm-hmm. So workplace safety was an issue. What were some of the other issues that came up?
There were concerns around like the way HR handles sexual harassment complaints. And then also just like through like talking to like a union rep, my coworkers learned that union employees like both make a lot more money than we do, and also just like have better benefits. So mm-hmm. it was more of a like realizing that our benefits weren't as good comparatively as they could be, and just being like, yeah, I mean, I would like them to be better now that I know that they could be.
Right. So what other bakeries were you comparing yourselves to?
there's Franz and then Safeway. Both are unionized, and Franz has been for like over 100 years. And it was learning that like those bakers who like have a like less, it's like less artisan and handmade, and it's more mechanized, so have like less issues with repetitive motion, mm-hmm. make, I think, between like, it's like 20 to 24 an hour is like roughly their range, and our range is like 16 to 20 ish.
It's a significant,
yeah. So it was like, you know, difference. That's like $2 to $4 more,
yeah.
And we were like, I mean, that'd be nice,
mm-hmm. yeah. I think there was another, I think I read something probably in something that Dawn wrote, that another issue was understaffing and not having enough people.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and again, management, I think, has kind of like misinterpreted this as like, we don't like employ enough people on a whole, whereas it's more about understaffing shift by shift. Mm-hmm. So there not being enough like workers scheduled on specific shifts to do the work that we're being asked to do. And so that meaning that like the shifts are constantly running behind, or if someone calls out, then you're just down one more hand, and there is no like system for like having someone come to fill in that shift. That's another thing that like a lot of older employees, that's really important to them, is like they've been asking for years, we need an on-call system, we need an on-call system, and just kind of being met by like deaf ears.
Yeah. Yeah. So are most of the employees full-time?
Yes. Most of our employees are full-time. Grand Central does do something that is really cool, which is that they allow, if you work 25 hours or more, you qualify for benefits. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool. And also, like, so I, like, several, there are a couple people on my shift and, like, some of the other shifts, it's, like, kind of scattered, who work, like, slightly less than full-time. Mm-hmm. So we have some people who work like 3 days or 4 days, but right. it's mostly full time.
Yeah. Well, it's great that they're offering benefits. That's really cool. So that's like one of those examples, like what Dawn and I were talking about, of like an employer that's not, they're not evil, they're not terrible, right? But that doesn't mean they're still not providing what you need as workers. Grand Central employs like 450 people-ish, right?
Yeah.
In Portland and Seattle. But the union's just representing your one production facility and not the individual cafes, right?
Right, correct.
So do you guys work with the cafe workers at all? Have you been doing any kind of solidarity work with them, or do they want to organize?
So we're like actually like really cut off from them because we work in a separate facility, and like all of like the bread is taken to them by delivery drivers, so we don't have like much of a like in-person relationship with them, and so it's hard to say, like I have not spoken to any of them, and or like the pastry workers at Fremont, like we don't have much connection with them. We did get emails to our like union email of support from a couple of cafe workers and like people in other positions in the company, just like voicing support and being like, hey, if you need anything, like what can we do, how can we support you? So I think that there is support, like broader support throughout the company. But I don't personally know if like, I mean, we would love it if they did. We'd love it if they wanted to, you know, have their own election, vote to join us. But I, you know, I don't know for sure if that'll materialize.
It was an interesting thing when I talked to the New Susan's Workers Union. They were in similar, like their stores are, you know, they don't talk to each other necessarily. Yeah. So they would plan like social events between the stores and had a Facebook group to like communicate with the people out of state. So it's one of those things where it's, I think, you know, employers often do that. Like there's no transparency in your wages, so you don't know, and there's no way to connect to other people. So that's another obstacle to overcome for sure. So what has the response of the owners been to the union?
It was interesting. At first, it was like, so we announced that we were unionizing on November 22nd, and that was the last Friday before Thanksgiving, and specifically also right before our like biggest production day of the year. And so it was like radio silence basically over the weekend. And then they weren't back in the office until Monday. Tuesday's our biggest production day of the year. We don't hear anything from them until that Tuesday morning. Our CEO puts out an email letter that's basically just like, hey, we heard that this is happening. Here are some facts about Grand Central and why it's great and why you don't need to unionize. And that was like the first response, and that was it. And then basically nothing again until like the 4 days before our union vote, which was December 12th, where they like suddenly decided that they wanted to have a whole bunch of captive audience meetings just like crammed into that, like just back to back to back to back, crammed into that 4 days right before the vote. Because I think they just like kind of got anxious all of a sudden.
Were those one-on-one meetings or?
No, they were group meetings, and it was really interesting because it was like not the whole shift, but like part of your shift, and it was just kind of like a random lottery assignment. Or sometimes it was even parts of two different shifts at the same time, but not all of any shift. And the thing that like just like really was not a great move was when they scheduled these meetings, because a lot of them were scheduled for like the middle of your busiest shift of the week, or just like times that like really didn't, like if you were someone who was like on the floor day to day, you would have known not to pick those hours. And so that a lot of people like went into those meetings and were like, this is a waste of our time.
And I assume felt bad for their coworkers.
Right. And like it created a kind of stress, because you know that like you're sitting in this room for 45 minutes or an hour, and you know that only like four of your coworkers are out there trying to run the entire floor by themselves on the busiest shift of the week. And you're like, I feel like a jerk because I'm sitting here doing nothing. And I know those people are like busting it out there to get things done. So I think that that it just like really didn't work the way they had hoped it would.
And so so you did a vote and you are now a union. What are your next steps?
Our next step is contract negotiation. So our local rep and the international rep have met with the CEO and have like set 2 weeks in February for contract negotiations. I'm very optimistic about that. Hopefully it'll go well. They seem to be pretty optimistic about it as well.
Very cool. So your slogan for your union, I love it, is Unidos negociamos, divididos rogamos, excuse my Spanish. United we bargain, divided we beg. Tell us about that slogan.
Well, so someone had, we had been like kind of just like snowballing ideas, you know, like passing things around. But we hadn't, we like really didn't pick anything out until like kind of the last minute. And someone actually said that in like, it was on Twitter, and I think it was a response to something else that our Twitter account had posted. And so like someone just like saw that and then like asked one of our like Spanish speaking, like I think it was our rep actually, because he's bilingual, and was like, hey, like, so if I wanted to say beg in Spanish, like how would I say that? And so he like translated that portion of it for us, and then we were like, oh yeah, like this is great, we love this. And especially because like so many of our coworkers are either bilingual or almost monolingual in Spanish, it's been very important to us that like we are able to produce all of our like internal communications to our crews in both languages, and so like our slogan, of course, as well.
That's amazing. Has organizing in two languages proved any, like, has it been difficult or beneficial?
I think it's like it's only really been like difficult on crews where there's like a high degree of people who only speak Spanish, and then like the person who's doing most of the like liaisoning between like the organizing committee or the rep is like monolingual in English. Because that makes like face-to-face transmission of like information harder. But the person who like is writing all of the like email communications is not fully, but bilingual enough. And so all of our internal email communications to all of our production employees are fully bilingual. And that's actually been like really effective in terms of making sure that all of our rank and file are fully informed.
Awesome. Cool. You guys are going to start negotiations soon. Is there anything that the listeners can do to support the union in that, or any asks for people who are listening?
I don't know if there's anything like specific at this moment, but you can find us on Facebook, Grand Central Bakers Union. And you can also follow us on Twitter, and that's @ G, C, B _ U union.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Lori.
Yeah, of course.
So that's it for this episode of The Food Show. If you have any comments about the show or future ideas, feel free to email us at foodshow@kboo.org. And if you miss any part of the show, you want to listen again over and over and over, you can. I'll also post links to everybody's organizations and resources at kboo.fm. You can also listen to it again and again and again on iTunes or the Google Play app. Our next episode will be on February 19th at 11. Until then, I'm Emily Becker. Thanks for listening. It's hard to take risks.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. It's 11:59. Next up, we have Jazz Lives.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
What's happening to working families in this country? Why is America's middle class being hollowed out?
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren wants to roll back the rules that make it harder for families to file for bankruptcy than for corporations and wealthier people. In 2005, Congress passed a bill that then-Delaware Senator Joe Biden supported, which made it more difficult to get debt relief for job loss, medical bills, or predatory lending, and Warren wants it overturned. About half of the U.S. credit market calls Delaware home, according to Forbes. On the campaign trail, Biden seldom mentions bankruptcy nor the 2005 bill when he talks about reviving the middle class.
We'll restore the middle class, which is the backbone of the country, which is the soul of the nation. Wall Street didn't build America. Ordinary Americans, given half a chance, have always stepped up to the plate.
But the factors that drive people to bankruptcy are central to Warren's message about helping working families.
And why is it that people, families, that work every bit as hard as my mother worked two generations ago, find the path today so much rockier and so much steeper.
She says folks who file for bankruptcy aren't, quote, reckless or irresponsible. They're just getting squeezed by an economy that forces them to take on more debt and more risk to cling to their place in America's middle class, unquote. Studies consistently show that medical expenses are the most common reason, along with job loss and divorce. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders agrees with Warren about revising bankruptcy laws and helping younger people who've been disadvantaged by stagnant wages and ballooning real estate and college costs. Both candidates want to cancel student debt and make public college tuition free, following the example of seven other developed countries. Political science professor at Cal Poly Pomona, Neil Chaturvedi, brought a class of his students from